Okay, so we will be continuing on with the higher training of concentration. We've talked about the various objects that can be used for concentration, and we've talked about the five hindrances. Do you remember what they are? You've had them every day, I'm sure, since in the last week, but do you remember what they are? First one,
sensual desire,
malice,
lethargy and
sleepiness, restlessness and regret, deluded doubt. Okay, so you know these are coming up as hindrances in developing concentration, because when we sit down to concentrate, our mind goes off to all sorts of other objects, and then those five, explore, you know. And why do they happen when we're trying to meditate? Because we are involved with them all day long. So we are very much creatures of habit, and sensual desire, like something that's attractive, something that tastes good, something I want, you know, status, whatever. Yes, right away, you know, we go for it. Malice, somebody looks at us in the wrong way and we're upset and offended, and or somebody, you know, doesn't like some small, the way we wash dishes, and, you know, we're offended, but we're very happy they don't like us and chased us out of the kitchen. But we're very offended that they didn't, you know, because it was criticism. So that's malice. Lethargy and sleepiness, I think, you know, happen regularly, not just in teachings, but, you know, regret and restlessness, Again, restlessness, the mind looking for something to entertain it. So the computer, the phone, anything, playing games, who knows what, we think of all sorts of things. And then deluded doubt, that just kind of comes up whenever too. Whenever we start to think about the teachings, think about something meaningful. I'm not talking about doubting, you know, kind of worldly stuff, but, you know, important doubt. I don't know if that exists. And then what's really hard is when you met the Dharma, you love the Dharma, it's so true for you. But you still want your pleasure, and the sensual desire still comes very strong, and the malice, comes strong, and then followed by falling asleep, lethargy and drowsiness, and then restlessness and regret. Oh, I have a precious human rebirth, but I'm spending it on my phone. I really regret that, but I'm going to do it again tomorrow. So that's restlessness, and then regret following that. And then you doubt, I really want to be a sincere Dharma practitioner. Is that really for me? Maybe rebirth, I'm not so sure it made sense, but maybe it doesn't make sense after all. And karma, the way they talk about karma, and it expands, and even a small negativity creates a big result, and is that really true? So this is these five are in our mind kind of all day long. So we're creatures of habit, so of course they come up during our meditation. But they are definitely hindrances, yeah, because they take us away into you know, la la land. And most of them, not all of them, are when our mind's involved in that, we're creating negative karma. And then of course, the more our mind is involved in those five, the more it comes out of our mouth and the more we act on it and create more, you know, destructive karma. So they're hindrances, not just in our meditation, not just when we're trying to develop serenity, but even when we're trying to keep ethical conduct. Yeah, because our mind just gets tangled up with all this stuff, okay? So the antidote is what we're going to talk about, the taming the five hindrances. But one way we try to tame the five hindrances, which does not work, is we get mad at ourselves, you know? And like, oh, there I did it again, you know, I wanted to do, you know, do something virtuous, and I started reading this magazine instead, and I said I would only read it for 5 minutes, but 2 hours later, you know, I'm still looking at the ads, and or whatever it is, yeah, and so then we feel, you know, instead of just regret that makes us change, it becomes guilt, self-deprecation, beating ourselves. Look what I did again. Ah, what's wrong with me? I will never amount to anything. You know, I have no Buddha nature. Everybody else does. You know, and then we sit and stew in our self-deprecation. Yeah, and have the notion that the more we feel guilty, the more we're atoning, and you know, for that, and that makes no sense at all. Feeling guilty does not purify anything. Yeah, feeling guilty just gets us stuck, which we can do all by ourselves. Yeah, So it's important, you know, just to look, to be on the outlook for all these things, and to learn the antidotes, practice the antidotes in our daily meditation so we get familiar with them. And then, you know, as we get familiar with them, then when the hindrances come up, we have an antidote ready. And when we get even more familiar with them, the hindrances don't arise as much. Yeah, because our whole way of thinking has changed. Okay, and now the thing is that we all wish that the, you know, the scientists and the farm companies, pharmaceutical, you know, companies would develop little pills that we could take to solve these hindrances, but they don't, they can't, and they don't, because these are mental states and we have to tame our own mind. Yeah, nobody else can do it for us, and no medicine, you know, can do it either. Yeah, so then we go, oh, it's so hard. And the path is so long. Yeah, Buddha, why can't it be easier and shorter? As if the Buddha created that and has some control over it. Yeah, the Buddha didn't create the path. He didn't create samsara. Yeah, we created our own samsara. Yeah, and we have to create our own nirvana. So the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are our refuge in that they teach us how to do that. But they can't swoop down and remove all the hindrances for us. And they can't make the path shorter or easier. And actually, I remember Lama Zopa once saying, you know, it's the hindrances that make the path difficult. Yeah. It's not the Dharma. It's not that Dharma is hard to practice. It's not that the path is difficult, you know, that creates the difficulty. Our hindrances, our afflictions are the difficulties. Yeah. And, yeah. Don't you think? Yeah. And who are you going to complain to? I mean, we try complaining, you know. Why am I so angry? They did this. Yeah. Why do I have so much craving? They put out what I like.
Hardly ever.
Hardly ever what? What we like? They don't, yeah. You don't, come on, you guys like flock to the snack table all the time. What do you mean? Yeah. And when they don't put out what you like, then we complain, don't we? Yeah. Which, by the way, I just learned that that coconut oil is very high in bad cholesterol. So we should, you know, temper how much we use it in the kitchen. Yes, it's high in bad cholesterol. Those sneaky little cholesterol molecules that clog your arteries and give you heart attacks. Yeah. So anyway, you know, we usually blame something outside. Why am I falling asleep during teachings? You know, I just slept 12 hours, but I'm still falling asleep. Why? Oh, because I should have been able to sleep 14 hours. I should have, you know. The sessions are so long, I'm so exhausted. You know, we blame somebody else. And the big thing is, you know why you're so tired? Yeah. Because you are deprived of
coffee.
Oh, that suffering. Tremendous. And how your whole Dharma practice would be totally different if you could only drink coffee. Try tea. Yeah, the Tibetans drink tea. They don't drink coffee. How do you know what they drink?
There's a very long line in Bodh Gaya, the cafe.
No, but they like the Tibetan tea better.
Yeah.
And why are you noticing how many people are at the espresso machine? Okay. Okay. So, let's visualize the merit field. Yeah, they are not drinking coffee. They are discussing Dharma and they have to stay awake to do it. This is why in the monasteries, you have your classes in the morning when you're awake and you debate at night until very late at night because you're yelling and screaming and at each other and jumping around, and you're not going to fall asleep during that. Okay. So remember that all sentient beings are around you, and the people you don't get along with, if they're not right in front of you right now, you visualize them. But so let's cultivate our motivation. So it's very important to remember the defects of samsara, especially the defects of attachment to different objects. Because when we talk about the cause of dukkha, the second noble truth, we're always using the craving as the example. Because we crave this, we crave that, we want this, we want that. And we're deceived by these objects, because when we experience happiness from them, we think, you know, life is wonderful. And this is because we think that those pleasant feelings that we experience from getting what we want, we think that that's happiness. But if we really look at our experience, it's not, because if we keep doing that same thing, or having that same thing, then we would really get quite sick and disgusted. And we can see that from in our own experience. When we eat too much, when you party too much, so something might be very interesting, but the more we do it, it doesn't bring lasting happiness. It turns into something unpleasant. So this is one reason why we say that the happiness in samsara isn't real happiness. One reason, because it's impermanent. It comes and goes, doesn't last. And second, that doing what or having what gives us happiness eventually gives us pain or discomfort. So it's really important to remember this a lot. Otherwise, we lack renunciation of samsara, and our practice lacks energy because of that. And similarly, when we don't have a good basis of renunciation, bodhicitta also lacks energy, because we start thinking that only the suffering of this life is something to be removed, and we forget that there's no happiness in samsara anywhere. So, you know, what are we trying to free other living beings from if we think that samsara has real happiness? Okay, so take a minute and really remember the defects of samsara, its disadvantages. And then have the feeling of renunciation for your own samsara, and then apply it to other living beings and generate bodhicitta. Okay, so we're on page 177. Did you do the reflections, your homework? Okay, so we're on the section taming the five hindrances. So His Holiness says, although we may think that we are the only ones in the meditation hall who are distracted, while everyone else abides blissful in samadhi. Does that happen to you? Oh, no, you think you're the one who's abiding blissful in samadhi, and everybody else is distracted. No, we usually think, you know, look, their eyes are closed. They're sitting so quiet. I'm restless, and I'm looking around, and then, uh-oh, somebody else's eyes are open. I better close mine. I don't want them to know that I'm looking around. Okay. Although we may think we are the only ones in the meditation hall who are distracted, while everyone else abides in blissful samadhi, we are not alone in having difficulty concentrating. Everyone must deal with the same hindrances in meditation. Yeah. So the hindrances may manifest as images in the mind. Yeah, things that pop into the mind from the past or that you're dreaming about in the future. Or ruminating thoughts. Oh, I want to go and buy this. How can I do it? What do I really want? What color should it be? Does it have a warranty? You know, so you're ruminating about that, or ruminating about, oh God, again. I put my robe here and somebody moved my robe there. And I am sick and tired of people moving my robe. Can't these people learn to keep their hands off my stuff? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Somebody went in my room and turned off the light. Who do they think going in my room to turn off the light? I left the light on deliberately because I was only going out for a minute. I stayed a little bit longer, and I know I'm wasting electricity, but they still don't have any business going in my room and turning out the light. Yeah, so you can ruminate. Good time about that. Yeah, that'll take one or two meditation sessions. Yeah, and then you can look at the same person and find something else. Oh, when they shave their hair. Yeah. When so-and-so shaves their hair, when I go in the bathroom, there's little things all around, little hairs all around. Yeah, can't they collect their hair and take it outside? You know, why is the bathroom dirty? Or somebody puts their slippers right where I'm walking. Yeah. Why can't they put their slippers on the shelves or under the shelves? Why do they have to put them right out here? Yeah, where I want to put my shoes, and where I trip over their slippers. Yeah. These outrageous things that mother sentient beings do. Yeah. Yeah, there ought to be a law. Take out the policy manual. We have to add these things. Yeah. Because they are big infractions. Yeah. Have to confess when you do them at Posada. And you have to confess when you get mad about somebody else doing them. Yeah. Oh. But then I'm going to talk the whole time at Posada. We'll never get to do the ceremony. Okay. So the hindrances may manifest as images in the mind, ruminating thoughts, or powerful emotions. Okay. So you remember something that happened in the past? Yeah, 15, 20, 30 years ago. Yeah, and you still get mad. Yeah, that one can be really painful when you're addicted to remembering, you know, those kinds of things. It's really important for us to make peace with the past and not just keep going back to some person did this. And I was crushed. You know, you have Sarah Bernhardt here. Yeah. I was crushed. Yeah. Now we have to make peace. That stuff is in the past. It is not happening now. And why did I get so upset about it? What was I attached to? So even if you're angry at someone for doing something, underneath the anger is attachment. You have your rules of the universe about how people should behave and how what they should do so that you're happy. And they are not following them. Yeah. Okay, so look and see what our attachment is. Okay, so everyone must deal with the same hindrances in meditation. Yeah, when a hindrance is not so strong, simply returning the mind to the object of meditation or renewing our mindfulness is sufficient. Yeah, a thought pops in your mind. Instead of following it, you realize, oh, distracting thought. Bring yourself back to the object of meditation. Yeah, when you can find it quickly, then you can do that. It'll stay there. If you don't catch it quickly, then it's much harder. Okay, but when the affliction is strong, when the hindrance is strong, we must temporarily leave the object of meditation and reflect on another topic to counteract the hindrance and bring the mind back to a balanced state. Yeah, because your mind's not sticking on your object of concentration. Yeah, so you have to go. So what we're going to go through now is some of the antidotes. I think many of you have, you know, you've been hearing Long Rim teachings and thought training teachings, so you've heard the antidotes, many of them. Do you practice them? Okay. In the discourse on the removal of distracting thoughts, this is a sutra in the Pali tradition, the Buddha taught five methods for doing this, for bringing the mind back. So in sequence, this is what he recommended. You start with one and then go to the other. Okay, so the first group is pay attention to a virtuous object. Yeah, so you're your mind is on a hindrance, there's a non-virtuous object, so you want to, one way to counteract is bring it to a virtuous object. So precisely contemplate the opposite of the distracting thought or emotion. Okay, so jealousy comes up, what do you contemplate? Rejoicing. Yeah. Okay. Anger comes up.
Loving-kindness.
What?
Loving-kindness.
Okay. Yeah. Our old friend attachment.
Impermanence.
Yeah. Arrogance. Something difficult, yeah. They usually say something difficult, like, you know, the five aggregates, the 12 sources, the 18 constituents. But you know what some people find really difficult? Apologizing and a forgiving. Yeah. When our arrogance is big, we don't want to forgive and we don't want to apologize. Do we remember that as an antidote when we have arrogance? No. Because it really was the other person's fault. They should have, yes, I should meditate on anger. Apologizing and forgiving. They should apologize to me. Because I am so great that I did nothing wrong. Yeah. Those people. Okay. So here's going through the ones for specific, hindrances. So for attachment to material possessions, contemplate impermanence. Or contemplate what you're going to do when you have credit card debt. Do you really want to get this object? And then, you know, go into credit card debt and pay very high interest rates on things. Yeah. You contemplate impermanence, that whatever material object you have or you crave is in the process of disintegrating. It's not going to last. And it's definitely going to go out of style. Yeah. Okay, for sexual desire, contemplate parts of the body. Yeah. Oh, well, I already am. That's why I have sexual desire. How contemplating the parts of their body? No, this is, look at what is, contemplate each part individually. Take the skin off and put their skin right here, stretch it out, or put it in a big ball right out there. See how it looks. Yeah, those eyes that are, what are, eyes are like diamonds? Yeah, so you take out their eyes, there they are, two eyes. Do they still look like diamonds? Yeah. Your teeth are like pearls. Take their teeth out, put them here, look at them. Okay, they're the bicuspids, they're the molars, they're the incisors. Is that what you're craving? Yeah. Oh, but their skin is so soft. Yeah. Yeah, and then you put it in a pile out there. Make it into a ball. Pet that ball. Blech. Okay. And their figure. Yeah, the perfect figure. Take the skin off. What makes that figure? Muscles, a stomach, intestines, Oh, such so beautiful. Yeah. All kinds of, what's the connective tissue? You know, lots of gooey stuff in the body. Yeah. Oh, but it's so beautiful. Yeah. Your long intestine, your big intestine. Just, I get the shivers. Yeah, right. Okay, so look at the inside of the body. Okay. For anger, hatred, and resentment towards sentient beings, contemplate love. No. I will not contemplate love because that person harmed me. They are a horrible person. They are not worthy of love. I am going to hold a grudge against them from now, not just to the rest of my life, but until samsara ends. And sure enough, your samsara is never going to end if you hold a grudge like that. We hold grudges, boy. Yeah? And we especially, you know, somebody does one thing wrong, then everything they do is bad. Yeah. When I was with one friend, we were supposed to give a presentation at a Dharma conference. We had it all planned out. It was a really good presentation. And the person organizing the conference said, after we were all ready, said, there's no time for it. Yeah, you can't give your presentation. I was mad, yeah. And I found that even though I didn't say to myself, I'm going to resent him, I noticed after that, every single time I saw him, he was doing something wrong. Yeah. Because he was just, yeah, everything he did was wrong. Everything. Yeah, so, and I'm the one who's right. And he didn't apologize. And this was actually at Vajrapani Institute. So there's a big stupa for Lama Yeshe there. Yeah. And I was mad at this person and walking around the stupa, being angry. Yeah. Am I still, when you walk around the stupa being angry, are you still accumulating merit? Yeah, especially it's Lama stupa. Yeah, and Lama is not going to favor your mental state at that time. Yeah. So then something dawned on me like, okay, I'm carrying a grudge. I just have put a stereotype on this person and everything they do is wrong. Yeah. And that's my problem. Yeah, so if it's my problem, I have to change it. Yeah, so just saying I should love someone when you are deeply involved in holding a grudge, saying I wish them to have happiness and the causes of happiness is very difficult. Unless you think, well, why is that person doing what I object to? It's because they're unhappy. They're miserable. What if they were happy? Yeah. What if this guy who canceled our presentation, what if he were happy and relaxed and didn't have pressure organizing this thing? Yeah? then he would have been entirely, he would be behaving very, very different. Yeah. So if you think, okay, if I wish that person happiness, then they would be acting different and I wouldn't be seeing in them the faults that I'm seeing now. So that can be helpful. Yeah. But just saying, I should wish them happiness. No, I want them to get hit by a truck. Yeah. One of those big ones. Yeah. That comes roaring up here. Then you think, what kind of person am I to think like that? Okay. So that's, you know, when you get tired of holding a grudge, then something changes and it's like, oh, I wish them happiness. Yeah. Yeah. The story, Tracy, looking at you is reminding me of your brother's story. Yeah. Her brother was a cop and was chasing somebody who, I don't know what he did wrong, but he, you know, her brother Tom was chasing him. And the guy shot Tom in the neck. Yeah, that could have been fatal, you know. So he was in the hospital for a while. It really changed his life. His wife was affected. Yeah, the whole family was affected. They were angry. And they wanted death penalty for him. And so at the trial, that's what they said when they testified, you know, they want the death penalty. And then what changed his mind? Something changed. What?
Well, I'm not really sure, but he went to a parole hearing and he watched the man, young man, come out of the custody area. And he had diabetes, he had poor vision, he had, my brother felt empathy for him. You know, all those years robbed from his life, this was like 20 plus years after he was incarcerated. And he just started questioning everybody's kind of bloodthirstiness around him, even his lawyer and his fellow officer, law enforcement officers. And he wrote me and said, am I supposed to hate this guy, you know? And I'm like, you sure don't have to. But yeah. He'd already come to some kind of epiphany there. So.
Yeah, some kind of feeling of, because he was a young guy. And then if he sees him as being ill, yeah, then some kind of empathy. Yeah. Yeah. So her brother's mind changed and he started going to the first parole hearing. He said, keep him here. Yeah. But then, you know, after that, he, you know, went to the parole hearings and was started to say, no, you know, let's let him out. And then what was really amazing is he asked the Department of Corrections if he could meet the guy, yeah? And so he went in and had a visit in the visiting room with the man who shot him, yeah? And they became friends. And his wife was still not ready to forgive. But when she saw the change in her husband, she said, I want to go in with you when you meet him. And she came in and he apologized to her and to him. Yeah. And so then at the following parole hearings, they were saying, release him, you know. And so he got a job in San Francisco and started working and yeah. And?
Well, he's actually started a clothing line.
Really?
for like gang kids and stuff. It's called Don't Do It instead of Just Do It.
Ah.
So that's kind of his tagline is don't do it because it's probably stupid to do. You know?
That's a good clothing line.
And they're really cute. And he actually he had a ghostwriter help him write a book. I haven't read it yet. I guess it's a little bit creative, but it's still he's turning his life's totally turned around. So
yeah. And so not only did her brothers, you know, forgiving this guy and wishing him to be happy, you know, that not only changed his wife and his wife's life, but it changed the perpetrator's life as well. Yeah, so it's possible, you know, when you think of the things we hold grudges about, I don't think they're anywhere near the seriousness of somebody shooting you in the neck. So if her brother can forgive that, then maybe we can forgive when somebody leaves their shoes where we're walking or, you know, picks up our robe after laundry or moves our robe or whatever. Yeah. Because the bottom line is, when we're angry, when we're holding a grudge, we are unhappy. Yeah. So if we want to perpetrate perpetuate is the word, our own unhappiness, yeah, continue to be angry and hold a grudge. If you're tired of being unhappy, yeah, then, yeah, let go, forgive the person. Okay, for anger at inanimate things, like the machine when I worked in college, when I was supposed to be testing people's, you know, ability, yeah, and to, what do you call it, you know, press different, yeah, responses, things, yeah, I kicked the machine, and it worked, it started working, but here it doesn't say kick it. For anger, inanimate things, analyze their components, the four elements, earth, water, fire, wind. Oh, so I can try that now with the computer. Yeah, earth. Well, earth means hardness, but I want to throw some earth at it. No, just calm down. No, God, you know, no, it's just an inanimate object. It's not deliberately doing it. Wait a minute, if it's AI, yeah, can AI deliberately delete what I just wrote? Okay, analyze the four elements. For aversion to situations, okay, it's like, oh, I have to meet this person, or oh, I have to do that. I don't want to go there. I don't want to this, you know, aversion to situations. Contemplate that they are the result of your previous karma and the circumstances that you do not have control over in this life, such as other people's actions, the weather, and so on. Okay? So your aversion to certain situations, why? Because of my harmful actions in previous life. Yeah. I don't look forward to seeing that person. Yeah. I would like to find out a way of not doing it. Yeah. Because I know they're going to criticize me. I'm sure. You know, you haven't even seen them, but you're sure what's going to happen. You know, why? Well, my own actions, and especially my hostility for that person from the past, then when it comes time, just to even say good morning to them, I'm like, no. Yeah. So, you know, why do we have that kind of reaction? Well, we've cultivated anger in the past. Yeah, we've cultivated grudges in the past. Why don't you have coffee when you want coffee? It's a result of your negative karma. Just sit with it, kid. Yeah. I have empathy. Even though I don't like coffee, I empathize with not getting what you want. But you still can't have coffee. Yeah. Why? Because I want to hold on to my power. And if I can forbid coffee, then I am powerful. I mean, look at what we do to try and feel powerful. Yeah? Look at what we do. We do all sorts of things just to feel like I have some power, I have some control. Yeah? And then we do that, and then it usually makes the situation worse. Hmm? There's plenty of examples, if you read the newspaper, of people who do things because they want power. Yeah. And does it, you know, do they feel happy afterwards? No? Well, same with us. Okay. For aversion to situations, we did that. Yeah. So seeing that it's a result of your previous karma, or see that it's a result of circumstances that you don't have any control over in this life. For example, the weather, other people's actions. We can't control those things. Yeah. Okay, for intellectual doubt, study the teachings. Instead of going round and around and making up your own, logical arguments for why things don't exist or do exist, you know, then study the teachings. I am sure the boogeyman exists. Yeah, the boogeyman exists because I saw it. I saw him. Yeah. Okay. Well, does the reason apply to the predicate that I saw the boogeyman? I think I saw the boogeyman. Yeah. Did other people see him? You didn't see the boogeyman last night? Okay. I saw the boogeyman because my parents told me the boogeyman existed. Yeah, and my parents are reliable sources of information. Oop, 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 oop. Okay, so. But study the teachings, yeah. Does the Buddha talk about the boogeyman? Yes, he is Mara's cousin. Mara. Are you afraid of Mara? Yeah, there's four Maras, you know. Your aggregates. Your afflictions. Your death. And your little brother. No. No, I'm joking. Yeah. But we'll find something, you know, whatever it is that bugs us. Yeah. Yeah, I love that story. I think it's in one of the books. I forget which one. And it's found in the Pali tradition and the Tibetan tradition. And it involves one bhikshuni, and she's meditating on emptiness. Yeah. And when she's coming out of her meditation on emptiness, Mara appears and says, you know, kind of, what are you doing? Of course there's a self, you know, you should believe that there's a real self, and trying to deceive her. And she looked at him and said, no, she was a bhikshuni, she was much politer. She just said, Mara, yeah, what you're saying is BS, go away. Yeah. So it's, we shouldn't, you know, the whole thing they talk of, the Tibetans talk a lot about spirit interferences and things. But His Holiness said one time when he was traveling, he was supposed to stay at a hotel, and the owner of the hotel had one room that they thought was haunted, and they put His Holiness in that room because they thought he would, you know, pacify whatever was there. Yeah, real nice, you know, but the Dhamma. Yeah, so His Holiness, of course, meditated on compassion. What do you do, you know, if you think that there's some negative energy, meditate on compassion. Yeah, meditate on love, wish, you know, compassion that they're suffering, love you, wish them happiness. Yeah, so the hotel owner, you know, the next day said when he walked in the room, it was clear, and he thanked His Holiness. Thought that was quite interesting. Okay. For emotional doubt, what would emotional doubt be? We know intellectual doubt. What's emotional doubt?
Self-doubt.
What?
Self-doubt.
Self-doubt, yeah. Can I do it? Yeah. Is my anger, is this really anger that I'm feeling? No. Yeah. Okay. For emotional doubt, contemplate the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Isn't that interesting? It doesn't say, go back and look at your childhood experiences. Yeah? It says, contemplate the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. That's interesting, isn't it? You know? Your mind is stuck in some kind of negative, emotional something. Yeah. Yeah. Put your mind on a virtuous object. Think of the qualities, yeah, of the three jewels. Oh, I can't remember them. They're in the first part of this book. Yeah. Go back and study what you heard. But it can be very inspiring to think of the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and think, wow, I can develop those qualities. Or another thing, yeah, for that kind of emotional doubt, or, you know, putting yourself down, is read the King of Prayers. Yeah, because when you read the King of Prayers, you know, ooh, your mind has to expand. Yeah, because on every single atom, there is a Buddha. There are countless Buddhas on every single atom. And each of the countless Buddhas on every single atom is surrounded by countless bodhisattvas. Yeah, and they're Buddha's teaching the bodhisattvas, or everybody's meditating together. Yeah, put your stretch your mind. Yeah, you go, no, that's impossible. How do you know? How do you know that there's not Buddhas on every single body, every single atom? Because they say, yeah, that, you know, Buddha's mind is omniscient, it knows everything. And where there's Buddha's extremely subtle mind, which is what Buddha has, the extremely subtle mind, there's also the extremely subtle wind. Yeah, that's the physical element of the Buddha, not made of atoms and molecules, but the Sambhogakaya, the enjoyment body, the emanation body. Yeah, how do you know there's not Buddhas teaching bodhisattvas on every atom? Yeah, so it's just real, it's real interesting, you know, sit and kind of think, you know, I'm sitting here and actually, and this is what the King of Prayers is telling you to do, every single atom around me, imagine this incredible thing of so many Buddhas, so many bodhisattvas giving teachings, meditating, discussing the teachings, generating bodhicitta. Yeah? Now you're going to say, well, I can't see it, but you believe in atoms, don't you? Can you see atoms? No. Then maybe on those atoms, you don't know what's really going on. Okay. So that could be something good for like emotional upset and turmoil and doubt. Okay, now this, so that was the first point. Yeah, which was put your mind on a positive action object. Second point, examine the danger and the disadvantages of those distracting thoughts. Okay, so they cause your own and others suffering now and in the future. Yeah, so it's easy with anger, jealousy, to see how much we're suffering right now, and then just to think, yeah, we develop that habit, we carry it over in the future, plus all the karma I've created from anger and jealousy. Yeah. But, and then, you know, my greed, how does my greed, my attachment cause my suffering now? Because I'm dissatisfied, I can never get what I want. It's not good enough, or I don't get enough. Or I get disillusioned afterwards. Yeah. Yeah. So the attachment also causes my own suffering. How does it cause other suffering? Well, if I'm attached to something, I'm going to go get it. And I don't care if I have to take it away from somebody else or cheat somebody else or lie to somebody else. I'm going to get what I want. Or I'll hurt somebody else's feelings. Yeah, so you just kind of, these are really good reflections that get us to think about our own behavior when we're under the influence of afflictions. How does arrogance cause your suffering? When you're arrogant, you feel like, hey, I'm good, I have power, I know things. Yeah, are you suffering right then? How?
At any moment,
there's so much insecurity because at any moment, something's going to come to you that's going to deflate or challenge you, and you're going to just freak out.
Yeah. So underneath the arrogance, there's fear. Yeah. because this could crash, and or other people could see through it, or I'll get criticized for being arrogant, or I've got, oh, I'm so good, yeah, but now I have to keep it up. What happens if I can't keep it up? Mm-hmm.
I find one disadvantage of arrogance is that I feel disconnected from people.
Ah, you feel disconnected from people. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, because when we're arrogant, we are high above those people. Yeah. And yet what we want is connection. Okay, so see how whatever hindrance it is, see how it causes your own and others' suffering now and in the future. Okay, so second point under that is they obstruct wisdom, cause difficulties on the path, and lead you away from nirvana. But I'm so exhausted. Can't I go to sleep at 5 o'clock every day? Yeah, you want to do that? Okay, so how does my lethargy and sleepiness obstruct my wisdom and cause difficulties on the path and lead me away from nirvana? How does that work? Yeah. Wow, she's awake to answer the question.
If I'm asleep, then I can't actually hear the teachings and learn the Dharma, and so there's no way to put that into practice.
Yeah. And if you don't hear the teachings and put them into practice, nirvana's way out there. Okay. And then the third one, oh, this is a good one. Like the carcass of a snake, dog, or human being hanging around your neck, they weigh you down. Yeah. So, you know, think of your affliction like a snake around your neck. Yeah. There's my anger. It's, yeah, like a snake around my neck. Huh?
A dead snake?
Does it say? Or it could be a live snake. Why not? Any snake. Yeah, it could be a dead one and a live one. Yeah, just think of it. I mean, that's kind of what it's like. It's ready to bite you. Yeah, or it's the carcass of a dead animal, like a dead mole or a vole or a rat. Yeah, your attachment is like a dead rat hanging around your neck. Yeah, your arrogance is like a dead rat. Yeah. Okay, doubt. No, I know, I don't doubt that there isn't a dead rat around my neck. But no, doubt is like a dead rat. Okay, then the third, you know, major point. Do not give attention to those thoughts. Ignore them. Yeah. So due to your negative thoughts and these hindrances, what you do to a person you don't like, you turn your head away from them. Yeah, so don't give them energy. Your mind is going over and over again. They did this and they did that and they did that. And it's like, pause button. Then stop button, then unplug button, unplug it, yeah. Okay, so don't give attention to it, to those thoughts. Ignore them. So this resembles turning our head away from something that we do not want to see. Yeah, in the break time between sessions, yeah, here's another thing, you know, engage in an activity that does not allow your attention to go to these thoughts. Yeah, so wash dishes. Yeah, vacuum. Yeah, go for a walk. Clean your room. Do the laundry. Yeah, or paint an image of the Buddha. Yeah, okay. So turn your mind to some other activity. Yeah, so I do that, but I turn myself to the contractors. That's the wrong thing to turn my mind to, yeah. That's just another hindrance. I need to turn my mind away from that. Think of how nice it's gonna look after the contractors do something. No, just realize, you know, it's your mind. It's our mind. Okay, so either ignore the mind, ignore those thoughts, or put your mind on something else. Okay, then the fourth one, examine the formation of those thoughts. For example, ask yourself, why am I thinking this? Yeah, I'm ruminating about, you know, what kind of coffee I'm going to get as soon as I can get away from my abbess and get to the airport and buy some coffee, and, you know, and I'm not going to confess it because, well, anyway, it's just a minor thing. Okay, so why are you thinking that? Yeah, what are the factors that led to this thought or emotion coming into my mind? Okay, so I was meditating very well, and then suddenly coffee popped up, or suddenly this person that I don't like, an image popped up. Why am I thinking about that? Yeah, why did my mind go to that? Why am I fantasizing about this? Yeah. So it's quite, you know, you can see, well, there's a lot of habit in there. The more I do it, the more I'm gonna do it. Okay. But to also ask, you know, is there something that recently in my environment or a memory or something that caused that thought to come in my mind right now? Yeah. Why am I suddenly thinking about I need a winter coat? Yeah. Why am I so, oh, well, I walked in the storage room and I walked past the area where there's winter coats. You know, I just glanced, but, you know, it made an impression on my mind. So then I start craving. Or, yeah, just, or sometimes it's something you read. Yeah. Especially if you're, you know, on the internet and you don't have an ad blocker, or you remove your ad blocker because there's some really interesting article that you want to read. You know, well, why am I, is that thought entering my mind? Because that's what I did. I looked it up on the internet and I'm thinking about it. And it said I had to close down the ad blocker. So I was just going to do it for this one thing, article I want to read. Oh, but look at the ads there. And look at what the models look like. And why, you know? So look at what we're exposing our mind to. Okay. Yeah, this I find this one quite interesting to really, like, why is this thought coming in my mind right now? Yeah. Okay, then another thing, from a detached perspective, watch the thoughts flow by until gradually the flow of thoughts quiets down. Okay, so some people can do that, where you just step back and watch the thought, the flow of thoughts, and apparently they slow down. I can't do that one because I get very involved in the thoughts. Yeah, if I start watching it, you know. Yeah, what I have to do is prove to myself that that thought is either making me unhappy, creating negative karma, or is totally stupid. You know, like, why am I thinking this? This thought doesn't make any sense. I'm ruminating about blah, 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 getting all angry about it. But when I look at the situation, I actually don't have any reason to get so upset about it. Yeah. So that can be helpful. Okay, and then the fifth one is called crush mind with mind. And the only description in the sutra was just crush the non-virtuous mental state with a virtuous one. So I think what it means is referring back to take a virtuous object and focus your mind on that. Yeah. Okay. When we repeatedly apply these counter forces to the hindrances and train the mind in serenity meditation over time, that's a key word, yeah, non-virtuous thoughts will decrease and the mind will become quiet, single-pointed, and concentrated. We will become the master of our own thoughts and will not be subjected to disturbing thoughts. Wow, wouldn't that be nice? To not be subjected to disturbing thoughts of craving, anger, resentment, jealousy, arrogance, picking faults. Wouldn't that be a relief? Okay, we will become the master of our own thoughts and will not be subjected to disturbing thoughts. This occurs not only through an unhealthy psychological repression of thoughts, but by learning to work with the mind in a constructive way. Okay, so we're not advocating repressing the thought, but learning to work with the mind in a constructive way, knowing the antidotes, applying them. By employing these five techniques in the proper circumstances and proper manner, with practice, we will be able to redirect the mind in order to attain higher minds. In other words, the four dhyanas and the four formless absorptions. Okay, now what's crucial here? Okay. By employing these five techniques in the proper circumstances and the proper manner. Okay. So when you're distracted by worrying about your health or somebody else's health, yeah, at that time, to get rid of that, should you meditate on death? No. Okay. Yeah. When your mind is filled with attachment and you're thinking of everything you want to go and buy, Is that a good time to meditate on death? Yes. Yeah. When you're distracted by, you know, your eyes are like diamonds and your teeth are like pearls, yeah, is that a good time to meditate on that person's good qualities? even their personality, you know, the good qualities of their personality? No. Okay. So the thing is, when your mind is up, yeah, with attachment, with restlessness, that's a good time to meditate on death or something, the disadvantages of cyclic existence, something that makes your mind sober, okay? When your mind is down and you're, you know, a little bit depressed or disgruntled, that's the time to meditate on the qualities of the Buddha, are fortunate having a precious human life, something that raises the energy of the mind. Yeah. And Geshe Thapke, have you noticed every single talk, he starts with talking about a precious human life and how valuable it is. Yeah. So why does he do that? He wants us to think about that. Okay. So we have to apply these techniques in the proper circumstance and the proper manner. So make sure we have the right counterforce for a certain hindrance. Okay, although we ultimately seek non-conceptual realizations, both the Pali and Sanskrit traditions employ conception in varying ways to the process of developing serenity. Okay, so our goal is we want non-conceptual realization of emptiness. Okay, but to get there, so some people think, okay, I want non-conceptual realization of emptiness. So any concept in my mind is bad, should be taken away, canceled, it's a distraction. Yeah. Uh-uh. Yeah. When you're developing serenity based on an, you know, your the body of the figure of the Buddha, that's a conceptual image, but you're using it as your object of meditation. Yeah. When you're thinking of your hindrance, like that dead rat around your neck, that's concept. Okay. When you're thinking of impermanence and how things don't last, how they're changing moment by moment as an antidote to attachment, that's conceptual. Okay, so don't think that the object of meditation is just to cancel all thoughts. What we have to do is learn how to use thoughts, certain thoughts, in a constructive way at a constructive time. Yeah, not just space out. Okay, for example, in the Pali tradition, the Asubha meditation on the unattractive and foul nature of the body involves focusing on the conceptual appearances of various parts of the body. Okay, so you're daydreaming about Buddha boy, Buddha girl, and all of a sudden you think, you know, think of their big intestine and what comes out of it every day. Okay, it's applying concept in a skillful way. Yeah, also in the Pali tradition, to meditate on love, and this is Pali and Sanskrit tradition, to meditate on love, we reflect on others' kindness and visualize sentient beings around us. So when you're meditating on the sentient, the kindness of people and how we've been a recipient of so much kindness in our lives, that's conceptual. You have to think about these people and what they did and how it affected you and, you know, how much you appreciate it. So the antidote to lethargy is to visualize sunlight filling our body mind. That's also conceptual. Or you do the breathing meditation for lethargy, you know, and you imagine when you exhale that the heaviness in your mind is coming out as smoke and dissipating, and you're inhaling, you know, bright sunlight, bright light. Okay. So all these involve conceptual consciousnesses. Yeah, because some people will, I've heard people say, oh, but analytic meditation, meditating on Lam Lirim, that's just all concepts. Yeah, your mind is going thinking about these topics. Well, yes, because they're important topics to think about. And, you know, the more you understand them, the more you get a feeling for them, yeah, the more energy you have in your Dharma practice, the less distractions you have, the better your relationships with other people are. Yeah. So using thought in this way is beneficial in counteracting incorrect ways of thinking, such as proliferating conceptualization, prapancha, namtalk, okay? A profusion of discursive, ruminating thoughts. These unrealistic thoughts distract the mind and lead it to negativity. Learning to think clearly and in accord with the truth the Buddha taught helps to remedy those kind of situations. So we did two whole pages tonight. Okay. So, questions, comments? Yeah.
I've been trying to think lately trying to have more introspective awareness and actually watching my mind is being compassionate to myself first. Because I think first I have to have compassion for myself. Otherwise, you know, I mean, the goal is to have compassion for others, but it starts with ourselves. And if I'm, you know, I'm the worst or, you know, then I have to feel that this anger is harming me. And it doesn't have to be, I'm giving something to them right away. It can be more like, more compassionately selfish, like, this is harming me, you know?
Yeah. When you say this is harming me, then you apply an antidote that is the opposite of what that affliction is. Okay, so applying antidotes is compassion for yourself.
Yes.
Don't think compassion for yourself is, oh, you know, I just feel so down, I think I'll go have a drink.
Yep.
That's not compassion for yourself.
It's doing the hard work.
Yes.
That's the
yes, compassion. Exactly.
And just another little thought. In the sessions, I've more and more, I mean, I don't always think about it, but I try and do like Tonglen a little bit. Imagine like smoke from the room, you know, striking down my self-centered thought and from, you know, try and pull it from everyone.
Yeah.
A little bit, you know, it's not always real consistent to do that, but, and then, you know, exchanging self and others and thinking, you know, they're no different than me. And
Yeah. That's the whole thing of, you know, if your meditation topic is something else, and you're going in a negative way, that's a virtuous thought that takes your mind away from that, that other thing, that hindrance.
It's from Venerable Tarpa. Says, what is the difference between paprika, proliferating conceptualizations, and Nantok from page 179?
Prapancha is the Sanskrit or Pali term. Namtok is the Tibetan term. Here it has tropa. Yeah, tropa can mean, that can mean the same thing. It's got, tropa is more like elaborations. Yeah.
If thoughts keep coming back, even after we apply the antidote, what can we do?
Either you keep applying the antidote, or if your mind is just completely bonkers and you can't concentrate on anything, then end your session and go take a walk or do prostrations or do work in the garden, do something physical, work in the forest. Yeah.
Venerable, what's the difference between turning away from thoughts, like when you're saying to ignore them, not give them your attention, like you're turning away from something you don't like, and repressing?
Repressing is kind of the, you know, oh, I'm so bad, I'm thinking this, it's a horrible thought, I'm so bad, I can't concentrate, I don't want to think about that, stuff. Okay, so that's repressing, yeah. And then you don't even try and apply an antidote or anything. Turning away is like, I recognize this way of thinking is unrealistic, it's not beneficial, I'm not gonna keep thinking like this. Yeah, it's a stupidaggio. And so I'm turning my mind away from it.
I was wondering kind of where do we find the balance between this kind of calm abiding concentration and the analytical, where how do we know if we need to lean one way or the other?
Yeah, it's good to do, if you can, a little bit of both. Yeah, what we do in our sadhanas, you know, then you're creating merit, you do purification, yeah? Then you might focus either on the breath for a while or focus on the image of the Buddha, try and do that as stabilizing meditation. And then continue with the sadhana, and after the mantra recitation, do some lamrim. Or sometimes you can do lamrim at the beginning to help you set your motivation. Yeah, Tracy's behind you.
When I was thinking about the first four of the hindrances, seeing that there's some kind of resistance maybe in each one of them, I started to wonder if doubt wasn't really the basis for most of these, of the first four, or at least, because if I had more confidence, maybe it'd be easier to get over some of the hindrances.
Yeah, it could be doubt. It could also be attachment. I just want to think about things that make me feel good. I don't want to recognize my faults and my hindrances. So it could be either one of those. Yeah. Somebody over here. Yeah.
I have two questions. One, practical advice, how you work with love and kindness in the place where it's hard to generate it for in some conditions. Last weekend, Venerable Konchok was meditating on compassion and love towards maybe conditions which we don't want to see in the world. I tried to meditate on love and compassion to Putin, and I did it for both morning and evening, and morning is what hard, but in the evening it was possible. I was in my mind hugging him and giving him love and all of that. And simultaneously I thought, what if I'm giving love to this person and his happiness is in killing people, essentially. If he's happy, he is killing people. So, and I still was hugging him essentially and imagining that, but that was sort of doubt how you generate love and compassion in such
no,
cases.
No, actually killing people doesn't make him happy. This is one of the, you know, the things. Why does he kill people? Because he's unhappy. He doesn't have confidence in himself. He feels helpless. He wants to have power. He wants to be somebody. If he were a happy person, he wouldn't need to try and manipulate other people and have power over other people. Okay? So when you're wishing him happiness, it's not, oh, may you kill a lot of people because that makes you happy. No, it doesn't make him happy. You know, and he's creating a lot of negative karma. But think, you know, what would happen if, you know, like he didn't grow up in the KGB, you know, and instead grew up in a monastery, hearing about the kindness of sentient beings and you know, just that became the dominant thing in his mind, then he would be a totally different person. Yeah. And you would really like him a lot more.
Yeah. Thank you. And another question, maybe partially following on that, because it's how to deal with hindrances. What if anti-vehicle, I guess, of disgust and fear and arrogance doesn't work? Essentially, if you work for too long to eradicate disgust to the point where you almost don't feel it, some people claim that that's possible. And with arrogance, the same. They work so much not to fear while being arrogant that the call out to authority does not make them, you know, fearing to lose an arrogant position, but more to grow and become even more powerful and arrogant.
I'm not quite sure. Give me one example again.
So imagine Einstein is claiming that he's the smartest person on Earth. And then whoever calling him out on that saying, you know, if you're so smart, why you're not happy, right? That's a good call. He's like, oh, tell me how to be happy. I'm not holding to my arrogance anymore. I know everything about world and, you know, worldly matters and quantum theory, but also tell me about happiness. And of course I will know it. And because my mind is so powerful, I will be even better. So there is this constant betterment and then it grows even more. Arrogance would grow in such case.
Then their mind's really messed up. Yeah. Then they're not asking a sincere question. You know, if you're so arrogant and you think you're wonderful and you know everything, then you're not going to ask, tell me how to be happy, because you think, well, I already know. And if somebody, you know, says, is your arrogance making you happy? You know, that person may say, I'm not arrogant. But you know what? Life teaches us, and we bump into circumstances that knock us in the head and make us realize, oh, I'm stuck in my arrogance. I'm stuck in my craving. Yeah. I mean, that's how I realized I had a problem with anger. I thought I didn't have one, you know. So then my teacher sent me, you know, to work with some people, and uh-oh. So, you know, there's something about life that it knocks at our faults. And if we can, when that happens, recognize, you know, I'm unhappy. And what is the affliction that I'm having right now that's making me unhappy? Does that make some sense? Yeah. Okay.
I had just two comments. One is that for me, when my mind gets really wonky and I have thoughts that aren't helpful, if I don't first accept that's what the mind is doing, I don't get very far with moving it, and the antidotes don't work very well, I think. So to really pay attention to what it is, and, you know, not distract or not, you know, repress or any of those things, but to really actually, this is what my mind is doing right now. That's very helpful to my mind. The second thing is that when my mind, if an antidote isn't working, I move right into mantra recitation, and then my mind turns, because I can't hold all that junk with mantra going. And so that's a nice way to.
I can.
Can you?
Oh. Yeah. I'm glad you can.
Well, sometimes maybe I can't, but, you know, it seems to work pretty well, I would
okay.
say.
Yeah, that's the idea behind mantra, that you put your mind on something else, and you're using words, you know, Sanskrit words, so it's interrupting the regular kind of words we use in our thoughts. Yeah, but I have a special talent. I can do mantra.
I also do visualization at the same time, so I work with a lot of things, I think, so it gets me out of
right. Yeah, and that's what's skillful about mantra, gets us out of the chatter in our mind, and visualization gets us out of the daydreaming with images. Yeah, because it's using the same skill, but directing it towards a different object. Okay, so we're gonna close now. What? Oh yeah, so next week, there's no class because it's the beginning of the Medicine Buddha retreat. Yeah. But there is class the week after that. So you have lots of time to really meditate on these antidotes. Yeah.